morning, everybody. Please be seated. Our first case this morning is Lopez versus Nevada Department of Corrections. We have Mr. Kilby for the appellant and Mr. Leslie for the respondent. Mr. Kilby.
Good morning, Your Honor. Robert Kilby appearing on behalf of appellant Eduardo.
That's Lopez. Case number 54174.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor. Your Honor, this matter stems from an alleged incident on June 29th, 2006, in which Eduardo Lopez, who was an inmate at the time at Ely State Prison, was housed with Jeffrey Troxell, who was what is referred to as a known enemy to prison personnel. On that date, Mr. Lopez alleges that he was battered by Mr. Troxell, which suffered injuries to his right cheek, his jaw, a broken nose, and back and shoulder injuries. Mr. Lopez subsequently filed an informal grievance on March 10th, 2007, which was denied as untimely, and then filed a first-level grievance on April 9th, 2007, which was also denied as untimely. No second-level grievance was filed. Litigation and tort followed versus the Nevada Department of Corrections and the state of Nevada on June 24th, 2008.
Counsel, I'm going to interrupt for a moment and suggest to you that we are well familiar with the facts of this case.
Okay,
and if you'd like to move into your legal
arguments. The crux of this matter is whether the court's 1973 decision of Turner versus Staggs obviated the administrative claim exhaustion procedures, and in this situation, the practical effect is whether an inmate litigant may initiate a tort action versus the state of Nevada when administrative exhaustion procedures are not, in this case, properly followed. Well, I'll concede.
Doesn't it make sense that rules in prison should be different than rules to the what we call Main Street? Doesn't it make sense to you that we need different type of rules, especially since these are they've lost many of their rights by being incarcerated?
Why I do understand that, Your Honor, Mr. Lopez's position is that via the precedent that was set by Turner, the administrative claim procedures were obviated, and in that sense, they were not. There was no need to comply with them completely before initiating a tort action. Under the Turner case, which is similar in the sense that minor children were involved, a 6-month claims period was provided, and in that case, this court found that equal protection clause was violated because government tortfeasors were placed on completely different standing than non-government tortfeasors. Government tortfeasors were provided with a six-month statute of limitations within which to file the claims, where non-government tortfeasors were not. That's the situation we have here. If a government tortfeasor is not placed on the same level playing field with a non-government tortfeasor, we're in effect allowing meritorious claims to go by the wayside if an individual and many inmates lack maybe illiterate, lack level of sophistication. They may be a person with a disability. They do not have access to many outside legal sources that, you know, you and I would, or a lay person on the street.
Let me ask you a question, counsel. Even if we were to consider revisiting or overturning the Turner case, and were to be a bit more lenient with respect to the time period within which to file an administrative claim, is it not true that your client simply stated, missed the deadline, and whatever the deadline is, we need to enforce it? I mean, isn't it just that simple?
Your Honor, I mean, as you stated it, it can be viewed it can be viewed as simply yes. But our argument is that the entire claims procedure is simply just, it's not applicable. So it does not have to be complied with.
So, and I understand that argument, and I'm really not trying to be contrary. I guess my concern is that whatever the rule might be, whatever the time frame might be, in my mind, compliance with those timelines remains important. And so I understand that your argument is much bigger than that, you know, that you want it extended so that your client can benefit from the extension that Turner may, in fact, direct. But again, I come back to, he still, whatever the time frame is, he still missed it. He didn't comply, didn't meet the criteria that is set forth under the administrative procedures.
Yes, Your Honor, but if the time frame is an unconstitutional time frame, what then it needs to be completely struck, or in the some sort of recourse needs to take place to address that.
How is it unconstitutional, counsel?
Okay, under an equal protection analysis, as this court is well aware, if a suspect class or fundamental right is not at issue, then the classification must be reasonable, not arbitrary. And in this situation, that we have a classification. We've got a victim of a government tort versus a victim of a non-government tort. Non-government tort, 2-year statute of limitations. Government tort, who's an inmate litigant, 6 months. That's quite a difference.
So now, Mr. Kilby, would you say that this statute, does this implicate strict scrutiny, or is it a rational basis review?
I believe it would be a rational basis review.
Okay, well, that makes it easier for the state to argue that the statute should be upheld if it's
correct, a rational basis.
Oh,
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah,
but
go ahead.
In order to get to the rational basis review, you first have to find that the classification was reasonable, not arbitrary. And our position is the 6-month time period is arbitrary. That is what was found in Turner. The court expressly said in Turner that 6 months is arbitrary. And I don't see a distinction here between the 6 months that was found in 1973 and 6 months in 2010.
Well, let me give you another example, because I've thought about this a lot.
Sure.
I think you have a good point, I mean, with this case. But in medical malpractice cases, they used to have a longer statute of limitations.
Right.
All personal injury
right.
cases here are 2 years,
right.
as you know, like
yeah,
in this
absolutely.
Case, except for many prisoners.
Right.
But now the voters voted to change the statute to 1 year.
Sure.
Now, that hasn't, I think, come up before us to rule if that's constitutional or not, but here they did it, and that's equivalent to the legislature voting and all.
Absolutely.
Don't they have a right to do that, though, if they want to change it to 2 years and 1 year? In other words, they set up a separate rule for medical malpractice personal injury versus every other type of personal injury.
Sure. Of course, they have an absolute right to do that, but as you're well aware, there's also a right of review of any statute that comes into effect. In turn, the same thing happened. The claim statute came into effect. It was reviewed. It's happened many times where this court has found statutes to be unconstitutional.
Have you looked at, how about California and other states? Because I know other states have similar cases similar to Turner where they've knocked out claim statutes.
Yeah, and I have seen the persuasive authority that there has been a tendency to move towards that direction. But at this current time in Nevada, Turner, I argue, is the controlling authority. And if we sit there and we start to take away what meritorious claims from people, even if they're inmates. I mean, there's an old saying, I don't recall the exact author of it, but, you know, a society is judged by how they treat their criminals. And if we start sitting here chipping away at this, making more and more hoops, if it's a frivolous claim, there's going to be a motion to dismiss, whether it's in the context of inmate litigation or any other type of litigation. A dispositive motion will get rid of that claim. So, but by sitting there making it in a de facto 6-month statute of limitations, meritorious claims can simply disappear. And I don't know if that's where we want to go with this. I understand where you're going with wanting to discuss, you know, the rational basis is a very low level of scrutiny. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the state, and I'm sure will make some very strong arguments on that basis to protect the Treasury and whatnot. I believe that the Treasury is protected by the cap limitations. A meritorious claim is going to be capped regardless.
Well, I know. I remember we did another case here a couple of years ago. The name escapes me off that, but where a prisoner was beaten up on the yard and seriously injured, and then eventually he was released and dropped off at his girlfriend's house or something. And I think we concluded that, you know, the state was immune on the beating part, but not on the dropping him off at his girlfriend's house when nobody was there. But that prisoner filed the action within the appropriate time period. So, I mean, it can, they have law libraries, or they have access to materials and all to look at these time limits, don't they? Mm-hmm.
They should. I can't say on a, you know, on every situation, you know, every set of facts, of course, is different. And I would hope that they would have access to a law library. I mean, in Administrative Regulation 70, which has been amended subsequently, which was in effect at the time of this incident, is 20 pages long. And going through it, while, you know, didn't have an incredible amount of difficulty understanding it, I could see why a layperson or somebody with a different level of sophistication or who was illiterate, a person with disability, may have problems sitting there protecting their rights in tort. The 20-page long document, it's not, you know, just like, then they provide them with a form, but it's still not something that would necessarily be the easiest thing for every inmate to do.
Counsel, I don't want to eat into your reserved time, but I do want to ask you a question.
Sure.
I'm having a bit of a hard time following or buying your argument about the difficulty of the procedures, at least from an inmate's perspective, in as much as your client was rejected once for an untimely claim, and then second time around, at the very least, he should have been aware that there were time frames that would have affected him, and once again, he missed the deadline. So I'm not sure how that's playing, but he certainly knew there were time frames that he had to be cognizant of. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, fair enough, Your Honor. I do agree. Mr. Lopez did it for me. He did not completely understand the process, whether for what that's worth, and I'll leave it at that.
You want to reserve? You have 2 minutes and 50 seconds left.
You know, for these reasons, Appellant Eduardo Lopez respectfully requests that this honorable court reverse and remand this to the First Judicial District for further proceedings. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Leslie, on behalf of the Department of Corrections.
Thank you, Your Honors. Clark Leslie, Senior Deputy Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Department. I would like to thank this honorable court for again allowing me to appear on behalf of a respondent for the second time in 30 days. I appreciate the chance to address certain issues. There are two types of administrative prerequisites that we're talking about, the exhaustion of administrative claims and the filing of an administrative claim, two very different animals. As you pointed out, Justice Cherry, the prison contract has unique circumstances that are uniquely in tune with the need for an internal review or grievance process. And that occurs through 209.243, which is the enabling statute that gave rise to AR 740 and the very detailed grievance procedure that an inmate must go through. That's important because the department understands more than practically anyone else the unique stature and situation that occurs in a prison, and that is filed with the administrators of the prison, first informally with the caseworker, then the warden, finally higher administration. Compare that with the administrative claim, which is more or less statewide, and it can be filed with the Board of Examiners or the Attorney General's office or any number of other people. Plus, that claim is sworn to and averred to be true and correct. So we're talking about different animals. I do want to emphasize the importance of the fact that the exhaustion of administrative remedies did not occur here. The argument is somewhat formulaic, and I would respectfully suggest binary in nature. So I'll quickly state it because I would really like to focus on the Turner matter. The binary nature of the argument is very simple. If this court accepts, as it must, that there was no exhaustion of administrative remedies, and there cannot now be offered an excuse for a tolling provision because that was not offered below, then this court must find that the court below, using the de novo standard, was correct in dismissing the action, part one of the binary, unless it finds, because of Turner or some other reason, 209.243 would apply and would serve to constitute a conclusion that that provision is unconstitutional as in violation of equal protection. I think, as we will see throughout the course of this argument, that is not the case. What I do want to talk about, and I think it's important, is the Turner case. As your honors are aware, in 1965, the state of Nevada reduced its absolute sovereign immunity and under 41.031 allowed lawsuits against the government for certain purposes and under certain procedures. Since that time, the legislature and the court, I think, have marched forward in a very exemplary manner, and metaphorically speaking, they have, from year to year, built beautiful edifices by logic and reasoning and laws and opinions that have forwarded our thought and our understanding of the governmental tort situation as it exists in our modern society. When all of us who were involved in that turn around, however, is in the course of patting each other on the back, we see down the road this ugly, broken down, dilapidated, roof collapsed building. That's Turner. That is a building that needs to be taken out of the neighborhood because it does not belong in the current scheme of Nevada law. I would like to mention and cite two very brief quotes that would begin, I believe, my discussion of this issue and why I believe that Turner must be overturned. First, and I quote, "In Burke, we explained that under the rule of stare decisis, we adhere to our previous decisions unless the party asking us to disavow precedent demonstrates that those earlier decisions were clearly erroneous." Justice Gibbons wrote that, and it is probably, and I don't mean to sound obsequious, but it's probably the best and most concise statement I've ever heard in terms of when stare decisis should or should not occur. The second quotation I would like to start out with is from the dissenting opinion of Turner, Justice Thompson, and he poignantly asked the following question. "If it is constitutionally permissible for the state to limit recovery," he was speaking about the Silva case and putting caps on recovery, "if it is constitutionally permissible for the state to limit recovery, how can it be constitutionally impermissible for the state to require that a claim be filed?" And that's really the essence of what we're talking about. There are so many things that stand out in terms of Turner. I have an embarrassment of riches, but let me just point out as many as you can stand before you tell me I'm through. But the decision, and I know you've read it, and it probably stood out to you in some respect, that decision notes that it is, first of all, they stated that they could have decided the case based on granting a tolling because of the minority of the surviving children. That would have been nice, and I kind of wish they had. But then they go on to say, however, we wish to also address the fact that it is a violation of equal protection to have two classifications of individuals who can sue. Those who can sue one way as to a private tortfeasor, and those who can sue in a much different way and restricted way as to governmental tortfeasors. In doing so and in saying that, however, they did not give any acquiescence or recognition of prior decisions that occurred in 1970 and 1971, and Turner was 1973, which held, for example, in Silva, that because sovereign immunity is one that was voluntarily reduced in terms of its absolute nature by the state, through the legislature and the courts, have the power to condition the manner in which recovery under that waiver of sovereign immunity can occur. The other decision was the Nuwama case. It involved the city of Reno. And the court held that you could have different standards when suing a municipal corporation versus a private corporation, notwithstanding certain language in the Nevada Constitution. When you noted, Justice Saida, that one thing that stands out in this case, well, I'm rephrasing and paraphrasing in a manner that's most conducive to my case, but that the inmate simply missed the deadline. It is important to note that there, not only do we have to have cutoffs, and as Justice Gibbons pointed out, the people of the state of Nevada reduced the statute of limitations in Med-Mal, but the cases have consistently held that in this regard, and the reason why equal protection should not apply in cases such as claims, administrative claims and exhaustion, is that we're talking about a right of action as opposed to the procedures by which you can engage in an action. And as to the right to an action, the legislature and the courts certainly do have the power and the right to balance equities, take into account the factors that are involved in these decisions, and then make a decision that is not violative of the equal protection right. Justice Gibbons pointed out, after asking some questions, and it is correct, that we are here on the rational basis standard, and I wish to emphasize that because it is a favorable standard for my client.
Tell us the rational basis of the whole claim statute here, or the administrative remedies. What's the rational basis? If a layperson would ask you and would say, Mr. Leslie, what's the rational basis for making it different for the inmates than Joe Blow on the street?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, the claims procedure, whether we're talking about exhaustion or we're talking about the administrative claim, doesn't matter. It allows for early investigation. It allows for the preservation of evidence. It allows for the early contact of witnesses while their memories are still clear. It allows for early settlements. If there is a dangerous situation, it allows for the early amelioration of a potentially dangerous situation so that other people don't get hurt. It allows for early settlements, and it does protect the economics of the state by knowing early on the potential need to set aside monies for a claim that has some significance. There have been other rational bases as well, but I would hope that those would suffice.
I would assume that there are many, many torts in the prison system. I mean, the batteries, assaults. I mean, when you put a group of people together that have that type of background, it would seem that this is a truism. Do you think that has anything to do with the rational basis of having them have to report this stuff right away? Or I should say quicker than the man on the street.
Absolutely. And the reason I would say that, Justice Cherry, is because what we were talking about earlier, this is a very unique environment. By having this process of requiring the inmate, while the facts and circumstances are still fresh, to present his or her case and allowing the administrators to investigate it, it takes this very unique environment, which many individuals have very little experience with, and it permits the administration to provide a report or a recommendation or an acceptance or a denial that explains why they are engaging in the acceptance or denial in the specific and unique context of a penal institution. It's one thing when you're talking about an individual who is injured because of a state vehicle running a red light. It's another thing when you talk about an inmate who is claiming that he has been injured because there has been a failure to supervise because his status has been incorrectly interpreted and he was wrongly placed in segregation part A instead of segregation part B. That can be made into an understandable report and comment by the administrators of the department, it's not so clear in the context of what we generally run into in our lives. So the nature of the AR 740 procedure that has been provided under 209.243, the enacting statute, that provides a very specific grievance procedure. And as I know you've looked at it, and I would hope and would point out to you again that I think it's 740.02141. It starts out by saying, as an inmate comes into the prison, he is given an indoctrination and orientation period where he or she is given an overview as to the grievance procedure. So the inmate is not thrust into an environment where this very important procedure is something that they're not made aware of. And in that regard, I think that it passes constitutional muster. And let me make sure I got that one right, because I did tag that. It is 740.01.1.7. It's called Orientation to Inmate Grievance Procedure. It is part of the appendix. It is found at page 9 of that 20-page AR 740. Justice Thompson, in his dissent, had many things to say about Turner. Very few of them were very flattering. And in the brief time that I have left, I would like to emphasize a few of those facts. He noted that Turner voided all claim statutes. And we know that in 1981, the legislature attempted to address the claims and exhaustion situation by amendments to 41.0322, 209.243, and 41.032 and 036. They stand really in conflict with Turner, because they do require a predicate act to be taken under certain circumstances if suing a governmental entity before you can then validate and proceed on with your lawsuit. For example, 41.0322 requires filing a claim. That is for inmates, but under 036, you'll note the distinction, they talk about a claim and they talk about an action. Now, we know under statutory interpretation terms, if there are different words, they had to have different meanings, and that's what we have here. A claim is one thing, and that would be the lawsuit that's filed in a court of law. That would be the administrative part of it, and the action would be what's filed in this court. Your Honors, thank you very much. We think there are two reasons why you should rule in favor of the respondent. Number one, the exhaustion of administrative remedies never occurred. And oh, by the way, Turner had nothing to do with the exhaustion of administrative remedies.
Actually, Mr. Lawson, that was the question I was just asking, Justice Turner, if I could ask you, is would you distinguish factually the difference between Turner and this case? And that is what you feel the primary difference is?
Yes. Now, I have a duty and responsibility to this court. There have been cases that came out. There is, I believe, the Martinez case, which stated that the Turner decision is to be more broadly interpreted. They carried it out as far as statute of limitations, and they specifically said, although Turner was related to 209.243, we would apply it to other claim statutes as well. But still, we're talking about claims statutes, the ones that are signed under oath, the ones that are given to the Board of Examiners, versus an internal exhaustion of administrative remedies. And in this case, the one that's unique to the department under AR 740. So we think that no matter what, Judge Maddox in the court below got it right when he dismissed the case because of a lack of exhaustion of administrative remedies. But it is also important to remove the confusion that currently exists with Turner vis-a-vis the current status of claims, administrative claims statutes, because it stands clearly apposite to what our legislature has continually done since 1973 in affirming that claim statutes are appropriate. And I would simply add, number one, they relied on cases in Michigan, and the case in Michigan that the Turner court relied on, the Michigan court has since overturned. And we cite that case in our brief. That's number one. Number two, the majority of states do allow and find no constitutional problem with administrative claims procedures. And finally, I think that the statutory scheme clearly indicates that it is the will of the people and the legislature and this court that administrative claims serve a good purpose and should not be have a cloud over their head or be subject to a problem down the road because of an ill-advised decision in Turner. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you a couple extra minutes. Give them 4 minutes altogether in rebuttal.
Counsel, as you approach, simple question. Is the exhaustion of remedies or the failure to exhaust in this case enough for us to deny your request? That is, that Judge Maddox's order was adequate and therefore resolves the case, unfortunately, in the respondent's favor.
No, Your Honor. Because of the equal protection issue where we argue that the six-month time period is arbitrary, I believe that the statute either must be struck down.
So. Well, let's play paper chase. I'll be Professor Kingsley and you be Hart.
Very good.
Exhaustion of administrative remedies is not a novel concept in jurisprudence in Nevada or anyplace else.
Fair enough.
Why should it be a novel? Why should it be unconstitutional are illegal in this particular situation?
Because this is a tort context, Your Honor. Most of the cases that were cited by the Attorney General's office had to do with cases that were either in a civil rights context, such as Woodford in a prison reform act, which required exhaustion of administrative remedies. They were also or cases that were primarily had to be resolved in an administrative proceeding. This is an action in tort, which, you know, by its very nature, you have a right to enter a courtroom in order to resolve the matter.
Well, what about counsel's litany of things that show that it's a rational basis?
Rational basis, okay.
Yeah, I mean, he listed a number of things, and
absolutely.
Knowing, having been a defense attorney all those years in private practice, I know what happens in prisons, I know what happens in jails. Is he wrong on anything he said about
that? No, and the items he listed are not wrong, but they are also the same bases that, let's say, an insurance company would have, or a non-governmental tortfeasor an insurance company will go through, early investigation, contacting witnesses, all early settlement. These are all issues that a private tortfeasor would also want to utilize. And a private tortfeasor, they have a 2-year statute of limitations, and we basically have a de facto 6-month statute of limitations.
But how could you compare a battery in a prison to a car accident?
What's the between a car accident and just a battery on the street that has a 2-year statute of limitations?
Good response.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I apologize. Sure. Going back to the holding with Turner, the counsel basically is reciting a lot of dicta. And what, as you're well aware, the holding is what matters in a case. And the holding in Turner is that a private tortfeasor needs to be on the, or I'm, changing it up a little bit, private tortfeasor needs to be placed on the same footing as a governmental tortfeasor. It's as simple as that. If we can look at dicta, we can look at dissent, we can look at everything, but we have the law of the land for nearly 40 years, and now we want to sit there and overturn it merely because an inmate litigate who may have a meritorious case, I just do not think it's appropriate to let a meritorious case go with a six-month statute of limitations when 2 years should be appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The panel thanks both lawyers for the interesting arguments in this particular case. I hope that the rest of the arguments are just as interesting as you gentlemen have presented today. This case will stand submitted, and I want to thank counsel for your